Can cytisine help in smoking cessation?
A combination treatment for type 2 diabetes.
Yet another indication for beta blockers?
Mutations in stem cells and subsequent blood cancers.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 26th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And we're recording this week, but we want to let everyone know that next week, that would be the week that has New Year's Day and New Year's Eve in it, we will not be recording.
And that's because during this particular time, that is from December 26th till early January, there's a paucity of studies for our listeners to be aware of. So we'll start again right after the New Year's.
Excellent. And of course, we're going to wish everyone a happy new year and a safe one as well. So why don't we turn then to the New England Journal of Medicine with this one I served up as cytisine for smoking cessation.
This is a routinely available medication, at least in Eastern Europe, where it's sold as an inexpensive smoking cessation aid, and it's been that way for about 50 years. It's a plant alkaloid. It actually attaches to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, very similar to a currently available drug called varenicline. We've known for 50 years that this particular medication, cytisine, is effective in smoking cessation, but it's never really been compared to what is called standard therapy, that is nicotine replacement therapy. It was a very pragmatic study. It was open label. Patients knew what they were getting, but it was a large study, over 1,300 adult smokers who were motivated to quit, and they actually called the National Quit Line in the United Kingdom, and they're randomized to either receive this medication, cytisine, for 25 days, or nicotine replacement therapy for 8 weeks. And that could have been patches along with gums or lozenges. And they also receive low-intensity behavioral support that was delivered over the telephone line. That was 3 or 4 visits for about 10 to 15 minutes. And what they discovered is at 1 month, the continuous abstinence rate was higher for cytisine than it was for nicotine replacement. And by the way, that was the same at 6 months as well. So this is a well-done study that showed that cytisine is superior to nicotine replacement therapy in helping smokers quit smoking.
Wow. Not to mention the fact that this is clearly something with which we have an abundance of experience. So we ought to be well aware of what the potential downsides are.
All right. The downsides are that there was an increased incidence of side effects compared to nicotine replacement therapy. Nausea, vomiting, or sleep disorders. Very similar to the varenicline on the market. Here's the upside. This therapy, 25 days of therapy, cost about $20 to $30. Comparable nicotine replacement therapy, somewhere between $100 and $700, and varenicline, somewhere about $500 for a 12-week therapy.
How about in combination with nicotine replacement?
It was offered to these individuals, and that is they could start on this therapy, and if it wasn't successful, advance to nicotine replacement therapy. But only about 4% of individuals did. Whether both together is better than cytisine alone is unknown at this time.
Sounds like one of those reasons to go jet over to Europe and pick up a supply, like many other things I can think of that are available OTC over there that we don't have here.
Well, you know, you'd like the FDA to approve it, but interestingly enough, there's not a direct pathway through the current existing regulatory and pharmaceutical marketing structure to actually approve it. So we'll see how this plays out in the future.
Sounds like jetting off over there is a good idea, at least to me. Great shopping opportunity post-Christmas. Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, then let's take a look at something else that is quite fascinating, clonality, age, and hematopoietic cancers.
Our red blood cells and our white blood cells and our platelets originate from stem cells. They're called hematopoietic stem cells. But these stem cells are fairly infrequent. We only have about 11 to 22,000 per person, and they rarely divide. Now, we know that most DNA mutations occur during cell division. So the fact that we have few of these stem cells, and because they rarely divide, it makes them stable genetically. However, there's an occasional person that will develop a blood cell cancer, and they're thought to be the result of not one, but several mutations in the hematopoietic stem cell. In one study, they had over 18,000 individuals. The other study had over 12,000 individuals. And they identified genetic abnormalities in these stem cells in about 4% of individuals. They were more likely to develop these mutations, these acquired or somatic mutations, the older an individual got. And there were three in particular that were most common. And these increase the risk over the subsequent follow-up of years of developing blood cell cancers by about 11 to 13 fold.
Wow. That sounds like a smoking gun to me. I'm pretty persuaded by that level of increased risk.
Even though they increase the risk, if you have these mutations, one of these three mutations, then your risk of developing a blood cell cancer is only about 0.5% per year. So it's still relatively uncommon. That's just a single mutation. As I mentioned, it usually takes multiple mutations, at least two or three, sometimes up to five, to develop blood cell cancer. It's not ready for prime time screening at this time.
Potentially, this could be used as a tool to help understand this multifactorial etiology relative to cancer development.
Absolutely. If you could show which changes occur over a period of time and in what order, that could give us great insight into the disease process.
Excellent. Since we're talking about treatment, then we're going to segue across the pond to The Lancet for our final two studies this week, one of them taking a look at beta blockers in heart failure and atrial fibrillation.
The issue of beta blockers is really pretty interesting. We know that people that have heart failure due to poor pumping function of the heart, that those individuals, when they take a beta blocker, have improved outcome. It reduces mortality by about 33%. It reduces hospitalizations as well. And that's been shown in several studies. The interesting thing is there's been some recent concern that in subgroups, they may not be quite as beneficial. One of those subgroups being people that have atrial fibrillation, where the heart rate is irregularly irregular. These investigators did a meta-analysis from over 18,000 patients enrolled in 10 different trials of beta blocker. Of these 18,000 plus patients, about 3/4 were in a normal rhythm, and about 16% had atrial fibrillation. And what they discovered was that when they looked at outcome, the patients that had heart failure in a normal rhythm had a benefit with beta blocker use, whereas the patients that had heart failure and atrial fibrillation received no benefit from a beta blocker.
So for those who have those two conditions concomitantly, then what are you going to do for management?
What the studies do show is that a beta blocker is not harmful. It does have some use. For example, in patients that have atrial fibrillation, have a fast heart rate, but those that have had a previous heart attack, and those individuals is clearly indicated. Individuals without those conditions, I'm leaning towards taking the patient off the beta blocker.
But would you suggest that further study specifically addressing this issue in that population would be important?
It would require a large number of patients. These are generic medications, and so the drug companies aren't particularly interested in it. So I think it's going to be very difficult to do, Elizabeth.
So for now, then, you're going to just tailor therapy to the individual. We like that. Finally, let us turn to another drug issue, the so-called GLP-1 agonists and insulin in type 2 diabetes.
GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist. Wow, what a mouthful. Whenever we eat a meal that's rich in sugars, our body produces insulin, and in individuals that have a pancreas that's not working, not enough beta cells, not enough insulin, their sugars go up, they develop type 2 diabetes. Typical therapy involves oral medications initially. People frequently need increasing amounts of medication, oral medications. Oftentimes they need insulin. GLP-1 does several things. It inhibits gastric emptying, so you don't get the huge spike in sugar. It also stimulates insulin secretion and it decreases sugar production by the liver. It differs from insulin in that it's not associated with the hypoglycemia. It's not associated with weight gain. So the question is, if you combine this with insulin, how does it compare to just insulin alone? These authors did a meta-analysis over 4,300 participants that compared GLP-1 in combination with insulin versus a number of different anti-diabetic medications. What they discovered was that the combination of GLP-1 and insulin, individuals were more likely to reach their target hemoglobin A1C. There was not an increased risk of hypoglycemia or low sugar, and there was a weight loss.
Sounding, of course, like a constellation of really positive outcomes, but I would still like to know more about the combination of something like metformin plus insulin or something else that we have more experience with and also that's less expensive.
Well, these are individuals that are late in the disease process. And as we don't usually start people on insulin, it's just the very end when the oral medications don't work. But what I think it does show is that this combination therapy of GLP-1 agonist with a basal insulin enables the individual to have very good sugar control without some of the serious side effects associated with insulin alone.
And I'm going to let you advocate for that, and I think that's fine. I would just devolve to my typical position also, that I just have suspicions about these things. So I specifically will call to mind the glitazones and some of the considerations relative to therapy with those. So what are we going to do about GLP-1 over the long haul? We don't have that data.
What you're talking about is a surrogate endpoints. And I think that's a very good point, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you. On that note, then, I think that's a great place to stop. I think I'll reveal that I'm going to talk about cytosine and smoking cessation on the blog. Once again, wishing everyone a happy new year. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Happy new year, and y'all live well.